The thing is, I think in music performance, we tend to see nerves as a weakness. If you're nervous, obviously you're not cut out for doing this. Nobody ever wants to admit that they're nervous or that they're scared before a show. But in sports, it's different. They talk about you talk about performance anxiety. You talk about the nervousness of getting ready. You talk about preparing in such a way so that when it comes down to game time, it's just we're just doing what we did in practice. It's nothing different. When I was younger, as a cellist, I always had this feeling, kind of like, oh, hey, yeah, I've practiced, but now I'm supposed to, kind of do something I've never done before. Like I should be today 10, who I should be 10 years from now. When obviously you can't be who you're going to be 10 years from now until 10 years from now.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman, which I hope inspires you through the personal stories of a fascinating diversity of musical guests. Juliana Soltis is an innovative cellist who has done extensive research to connect listeners with some forgotten stories of classical music. In this episode, we talked about her recent album, American Woman, which features cello and piano music of women composers. You'll hear Juliana's insights into the lives of Mary Howe, Amy Beach, Margaret Bonds, Helen Crane, Dorothy Rudd Moore, and Florence Price, and hear excerpts from this album, which Juliana recorded with the wonderful pianist Ruoting Lee. Many listeners will be familiar with Juliana's playing as a Baroque cellist, and it was fascinating to hear about how the French relinquished their beloved viol reluctantly to the Italian cello. I really love Juliana's recording of the complete suites for solo cello of J.S. Bach, and you'll hear some music from her album Going Off Script, the ornamented suites for cello. Juliana shared great advice about performing from an athlete's perspective and also the joy of connecting with audiences. This interview begins with one of her beautiful greyhounds, and for those of you watching this on YouTube, hopefully you'll enjoy this comforting canine presence throughout this inspirational conversation. Like all my episodes, you can watch the video or listen to the podcast on all the podcast platforms, and I've also linked the transcript to my website, leahroseman.com. It's a joy to bring these inspiring episodes to you every week, and I do all the many jobs of research, production, and publicity. Have a look at the description of this episode, where you'll find all the links, including timestamps and different ways to support this podcast. Hi, Juliana. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
So for those people watching, which of your dogs is this that they can see?
This is Cece. You can see sort of his side right here. He's now the older of my two boys. He was the younger, and his sibling, his brother from another mother, Rain, passed away just before the new year. And he's staring at my new greyhound, Rocky, who is lying in the bed that Cece wants to be in, and Rocky's not getting up.
I'm also a dog lover, and it's great. So often, I've had podcast guest dogs in the picture, but not quite to this extent. So it's really nice.
Well, yeah, greyhounds are really rather long, so they can take up a lot of screen space.
So I'm so looking forward to this conversation. You're such an interesting and beautiful musician. And we're going to focus very much on your recent album, American Woman, but I hope to get into some of your other projects and your life as a musician, which is so varied. So Ruoting Lee, the pianist. Did you know her before quite a bit before you started this project?
No, actually, Ting and I were brought together by my late producer Joe Patrich specifically for this project. I had started working on American Woman with another pianist, and things didn't work out, and there was a moment there where it looked like the whole project was dead in the water, which was just devastating because it, was years of research had gone into this, and of course all the time that you spend tracking down the scores. I think the Margaret Bonds Troubled Water took me 6 months alone to find a copy of that score, which exists only in manuscript, and I thought, I can't believe this is it. And Joe felt very strongly that the music needed to be recorded, and so he donated studio time to the project, and he introduced me to Ting, who he was mentoring to be a recording engineer and producer herself. We just hit it off. Sometimes as musicians, you really hit it off. You have similar ways of playing, similar ways of thinking about the music, and we put all of that together, if you condense the time, the sessions that were spread out over several months in just a matter of weeks, which is astonishing.
And have you performed this program live?
I have performed portions of this program live. I've been doing a lot of promotional touring for the album. Radio stations big and small across the US haven't made it up to Canada yet. I don't know, being an American cellist, I kind of like I'm starting to wonder if I'm gonna be welcome in Canada at the present moment. Just a shame because I love Canada and I love it when I get to visit and perform. But not in its entirety. Actually, the first, I think, full rendition of this program that I'm going to give is in just a couple weeks. And it's going to be at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts at Lincoln Center in New York City. And we're going to highlight not just the incredible work of these composers, but also the role that the library plays in protecting the works of our most vulnerable artists, because several of the works that appear on the album can only be found in the archives of the library. And were it not for their passion for protecting, our art, our music, and protecting the legacy of our artists, all of that could have been lost to history.
Yeah, when I was looking up some of these composers like Helen Crane, the first Google result was actually the New York Public Library.
Helen Crane's works reside only at the public library, with the exception of one piece. And what's really wonderful is that anybody, literally anybody, whether you are a musician or a professional musician or a passion player or a professor or a teacher or just somebody who loves music and is interested in music, you can go to the library, you can make an appointment, and they will pull those pieces for you, and you can look at them yourself. You can engage with her papers, you can read her letters, you can look at her concert programs, and it's such a fantastic resource. I mean, you think about the level of gatekeeping that can sometimes occur with libraries when you're trying as a researcher to gain access to something and you're like, I just need 10 minutes with this score, or I really just need to read this one letter. And sometimes it can be a month-long process to gain access to those materials, but it's the New York Public Library. It's there for anyone and everyone, and the staff is just wonderful. They're the most delightful people. If I could live at the public library, I probably would.
So Mary Howe was a composer I wasn't familiar with, and this Ballade Fantastique is really a great piece. So I was hoping we could include a clip of that, and of course the album will be linked right in the description so people can go and hear the whole thing.
Mary Howe, I hadn't heard of either. Most people who have heard of her have some kind of connection to what locals call the DMV, which is not the Department of Motor Vehicles. It is stands for the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia, and it's what people from the area call the Washington, D.C. metro area. And the reason they know Mary Howe is because she is perhaps the greatest patron in the performing arts in the history of the district. She is one of the founders of the National Symphony Orchestra. She also at one point sits on the board for what was then called the National Center for the Arts and is now the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. I think there can be a temptation to look at Mary Howe and to look at her contributions as a patroness to the arts and say, okay, this was just a matron, society matron. She wanted to compose. Maybe she wrote a little parlor song or two. Isn't that sweet? But she's a formidable composer. She has her works performed by the New York Philharmonic, the London Philharmonic, by the Vienna Philharmonic at a time when they were kind of notoriously unfriendly to both women and to foreign composers, certainly. But they loved her. The wind players in the orchestra loved her music so much that they commissioned her to write another piece, her wind quintet from 1957. I think that maybe she's been overlooked because some critics called her compositional style derivative. She had this very unique way of writing that she called spanning and bridging, in which she took musical styles from the past and then blended them with contemporary musics to create this very individualized, hybridized musical language. And they're like, ah, you know, you're just borrowing. And I love that she had a very simple response to them, which is that I write what I want to write. And it's fantastic. I love it. The Ballade Fantasque is this just, it's like this incredible pantomime tone poem. There's so much going on, so many colors, so many moods, so many different characters in the music. And you know, as a musician, that's just wonderful to play around with.
This is a clip from Ballade Fantasque by Mary Howe. And she also founded the Society of American Women Composers.
She did. She co-founded it along with Amy Beach. And I have to mention, one of my favorite artifacts at the Library of Performing Arts, it's a photograph. And it's a photograph of the moment when the Society of American Women Composers is founded after a breakfast for the Society of American Pen Women, which is a group that still exists today. And it's all women who write things. So novelists and journalists and poets, and of course, at the time, composers too. And so all of these women composers are there, and they find each other and realize that they're not alone. I'm getting a nose in the neck. And so they decide to found their own group, which sadly no longer exists. But at the time, it includes Amy Beach and includes Mary Howe and so many incredible women whose stories and whose music haven't necessarily survived into our modern canonical view of classical music. But there's so much to explore.
So what was the impetus for you starting this research project?
It actually started, like so many things, during the pandemic. You know, I still think people don't quite realize that for those of us who are performers, particularly in classical music, sometimes we schedule things years in advance. And within a matter of weeks, everything evaporated. My schedule cleared out. It was unreal. And suddenly we're all at home. We have all this time on our hands. And I really wanted to, one, to do something that I could, you know, keep doing and I could see through to completion at a time when everything was so up in the air. And I had started to wonder about the idea of American identity in classical music. You know, I'm always described as American cellist, Juliana Soltis. And I thought, you know, I really don't know what that means. If you're an Italian cellist, you have this incredible lineage of music behind you that's part of your heritage. There's Boccherini and there's Verdi and Puccini and so many wonderful composers. And there's a sense of identity there just in the music. And I really have no idea what it means to be a cellist in terms of my own American repertoire. And so I started to explore that idea and think, oh, this will make a great album. And I ended up with a short list of 20 pieces, which isn't very short. And I was trying and trying and trying to whittle this list down without compromising the narrative, and literally banging my head on the coffee table in the living room. It's like, come on, you know, you figure this out. And I realized finally that for every male composer, for every man whose name I knew, whose music I knew, there was always a contemporary woman counterpart whose music I either knew only in passing, or who had been mentioned maybe as a novelty in one of my music history courses, or who I didn't know at all. And yet they formed this continuous history of which I had been completely unaware. And I thought, this is the story, that this lost legacy, this secret history of women who have been continuously composing in American classical music. And I thought, this is the album that I have to make. And that immediately followed by the thought that, oh, good Lord, nobody's gonna let me make this album. But I was, you know, gonna do it anyways. And luckily I found other collaborative artists along the way, including the incredible team of people at Parma Recordings who shared my passion for this project and made it happen.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, you'd mentioned Amy Beach, and she's a wonderful composer. I do love her writing. I don't know if you had heard, I did an interview with Samantha Ege recently. She's a musicologist and pianist. Mm-hmm. So we talked about, she had written a book recently about the Black women composers and their sisterhood. And actually it was interesting because it's not just about the performers, but the fundraisers and the impresarios and all the community that you need to mm-hmm. support that. But, you know, Amy Beach was quoted as saying that the African population is too small for its songs to be considered American. The white women composers were not welcoming the Black women composers.
No, sadly not. If you look at that photograph that I mentioned at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts, the one thing that is conspicuously missing, and was honestly conspicuously missing from a larger photo of the Society of American Pen Women at the time, there are no Black women in there. And it really is a shame. And I think that it is a problem that can persist to this day. I think one of the obstacles in facing modern feminism, both in the US and abroad, is that there is often a racial divide. There's an idea that, you know, if your skin is this color and you're a woman, these are your problems. And if your skin is this color and you're a woman, well, those are your problems, rather than seeing that there is common cause. And certainly these women, many of these women were writing and working all at the same time. And you do get the impression that if their skin tones did not match, their paths did not cross, which again is it's a terrible loss. Anytime that we miss that opportunity to connect with other artists, anytime we miss that opportunity to expand our minds and to expand our concept of the human experience, of the American experience, we're really missing out.
Mm-hmm. So in my episode with Samantha Ege, I did feature Margaret Bond's Troubled Water, the piano version, mm-hmm. which I love that piece. And I love this cello version. And you said it took a while to find the manuscript. So this was the manuscript for the arrangement of the cello and piano version?
It's never been published. As you mentioned, Troubled Water is part of Margaret Bond's larger piano work, Spiritual Suite. Mm-hmm. And the cellist Kermit Moore asks Margaret Bonds, who he knew, to please transcribe this movement of Spiritual Suite for cello and piano. And so it only exists in the manuscript copy that she made for him. And I was provided with, and for which I'm very grateful, a facsimile of that manuscript. And as difficult as manuscripts can be to read, you know, essentially you're reading, you're trying to decipher somebody's handwriting, and we know how hard it can be to just, you know, say, read, you know, the doctor's handwriting on a prescription slip. So it's the same thing when you're reading handwritten music. But there are always little details in a handwritten manuscript that you don't get in a published score, including that Bonds wrote a little note to Kermit Moore at the top of the page, you know, to Kermit, you know, this was a true labor of love, this transcription that she made just for him, I believe in 1964. And I have to say, it was worth every second, every email, every ounce of effort that I put into tracking it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is an excerpt of Troubled Water by Margaret Bonds. You can also hear the original piano version in my episode with Samantha Ege.
Interesting. We'll get back to that album, but people know you mostly as a Baroque cellist.
This is true. the album, the new album, I think really came out of left field for a lot of people who only know me from my two previous albums, which, as you mentioned, both are on Baroque cello.
So I was looking at your main teachers, and I was kind of curious about your path, and also, were you still playing modern cello when you were mostly playing Baroque cello for many years?
I actually did not touch a modern cello for about 10 years. I was playing Baroque exclusively. You know, some of that, you know, other musicians, you know, anybody who's working will understand this. You do what people will pay you to do. That's kind of the thing about being a professional musician, is that, you know, hopefully people are giving you money to pay your electric bill in exchange for doing this thing that you love so much to do. So, you know, people were hiring me to play Baroque cello, and certainly I absolutely love playing Baroque cello. And it was, I think, my interest in exploring those forgotten stories of classical music that really led me to early music. And again, it was during the pandemic when, you know, we all had a lot of time to sort of think and to face the reality of our own mortality when faced with this, you know, indiscriminate virus, that I started thinking about the course of my life and my career, and about what was I going to most regret not doing. And for me, the answer was that what was really most important to me was to tell these forgotten stories or these untold stories in classical music, and that those certainly weren't just limited to the Baroque era. And so that's when I picked up the modern cello again, and again, that's where American Woman got its start.
And some listeners won't be familiar with the technical differences with Baroque cello, the lack of an end pin, for example. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Well, you know, most people, like you said, they know a cello from, say, a performance of an orchestra or a string quartet. And, you know, it looks like a big violin, and it's got that metal peg on the end of it, which retracts into the body of the instrument. The English call it the spike, which sounds pretty cool. And we, you know, here in the US, we just call it the end pin, not nearly as cool. Modern cellos, certainly at least since about, I'd say, the middle of the 20th century here in North America, are strung with steel strings, have a steel core, and then some kind of other metal winding around them. But the Baroque cello is a very different animal. Now, it still looks kind of like a big violin, but it's missing the end pin. The end pin doesn't come into play with the cello until, oh, I'd say about the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. We have a really interesting, I think it's an etching of the great cellist Alfredo Piatti playing in concert with no end pin. And this is really in the fat part of the 19th century there. The Dvorak cello concerto, you know, which is one of the just thundering mortal masterworks of our repertoire, was premiered on a cello with no end pin. I haven't tried it yet, but it's definitely on my bucket list. I wonder if it makes it any easier. Probably not. But Baroque cellos are also strung with gut strings, animal gut strings, usually sheep gut, sometimes a beef gut, you know, cow gut. I'm a vegetarian. The lower strings are wound with that metal, that wire winding, but the upper strings are just bare animal gut. They produce a beautiful, warm sound. It's not the loudest sound, but Baroque string instruments aren't made for punching to the back of a 1,000-seat concert hall. They are made for playing in small, intimate spaces, either in the home or perhaps in the grand parlor of your palace, if you are a member of the aristocracy. And they sort of fill the room with this beautiful ambient cloud of sound. So it's something that's supposed to be kind of experienced in 360 degrees rather than, you know, punching back to the cheap seats.
And your first album, which is Entrez le Diable, which is Baroque French music, you had done some research for that as well.
That actually started as my graduate thesis when I did a second master's at Oberlin Conservatory in their historically informed performance department. And my teacher was Katerina Weinz Caldwell, who, in addition to being one of the cellists of the Cleveland Orchestra for many, many years, is a wonderful viola da gamba player. And with her husband, the late James Caldwell, collected the Caldwell collection of viols, which is spectacular. I used to just be in awe when I would walk into her house and they'd hold be hanging there on the wall like it was nothing. But, you know, Kathy really liked her cello students to play viol. And when I came to her, I didn't play viol. I hadn't been interested at all. And so, but, you know, she was my teacher and I was going to be a good little student and do as I was told. And I picked up the viol. And I started to realize that there were some astonishing similarities between viol music and the techniques that are used to play it and cello music of the same period, particularly in France, that a lot of cellists consider to be quote-unquote unplayable. And I thought, well, I bet that about the time that the French started switching from viol to cello, because they held on to the viola da gamba as an instrument for far longer than anywhere else in Europe. It was very tied up in their sort of national musical identity, this instrument and its sound. I thought, well, what if they are taking that technique and just applying it to the cello? Mm-hmm. And what if the composers are just taking those techniques and putting them into their music? And so I think my master's thesis was sheep in wolves' clothing, the case for a viol-based technique in 18th century French cello playing. And the more I researched, the more I found that this was actually like a culture wars kind of moment in 18th century France. There's actually a book, a little treatise, that is called In Defense of the Bass Viol Against the Enterprises of the Cello and Violin. You know, like these invading Italian instruments are coming for our soul. And I found that this was very real for them, that it was a very big deal when the cellist Lanzetti plays at the Concert Spirituel for the first time. And the impact that it has, it's a little like when all the Italian musicians started going to England during the reign of the Hanoverian kings. and you see this change in English music. It becomes less that homegrown, that indigenous kind of English music with their unique harmonies, and becomes much more Italianate. A friend of mine who studies that particular period calls it the greatest tragedy in the history of English music. It's when the Italians came. And so it's a similar thing. The composer, Jean-Baptiste Barrière, starts out writing in a very, very French way, very informed by viol music. And then he goes to Italy for a while. And he lives and he works and he studies in Italy. And he comes back and his music has completely changed. It's much, much more Italian. That devil cello has finally triumphed. And all this happens within like 25 years. Which is absolutely incredible to think about that kind of change happening in that, you know, comparatively short amount of time. And again, that for the French, this was a real moment of cultural crisis. So what we think we're going through today is honestly nothing new. Everything old is new again.
So I'm curious about, you said people considered some of this music unplayable. So did it have to do with the tuning of like the strings being closer together intervallically on a gamba, or what was made it easier to play from that perspective?
There are ways in which you will understand this as a violinist. We are taught to play a certain way when we play violin family instruments. There's a lot of finger independence, we very rarely bar our finger. Yeah. Across the string, because let's face it, the intonation is not going to be super accurate, and the next thing you know, you're kind of trying to twist your way to like get that one note of the two that's not in tune in tune. But in viol playing, it's incredibly common. The fingerboard's a little bit flatter. Mm-hmm. You have frets, and barring your fingers across, and in fact preparing those chords sometimes several notes ahead of time, is considered to be extremely good viol playing technique. Whereas on a string violin family instrument, if you don't need that finger down, don't put it down. You're wasting your energy, right? Mm-hmm. And you're risking tendonitis because you're expending all this extra force. But it's very common in viol playing. And one of the things that can be most difficult for cellists in playing some of this French repertoire is that there are just fistfuls of notes. And if you don't prepare them in the same way that a viol player would prepare those chords, there's no way that you are going to catch them in time, or that they will be in tune. So the minute that I started thinking less like a cellist and more like a viol player, it was like the music just completely opened up to me. And what before had been a physical struggle was suddenly quite easy. It was amazing. I mean, I thought it can't possibly be this simple, and yet it was. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's a beautiful album, and I encourage people to check it out.
Well, thank you.
And your Bach album, it just absolutely blew my mind. Like, so incredible.
Oh, thank you so much. The Bach album, people either love it or they hate it, but I'm okay with that. Mm. Because at least they're having a strong reaction to it. I think my greatest fear as a performer is for people to be like,
Yeah.
No, it's okay. It's like, I'd really rather you hate it than just be kind of like, about it. So I'm glad that you loved it. I loved making it. And I love playing Bach that way. I wish that more performers would take that risk. But I do think that there's still a considerable taboo about improvising on Bach, even though it is most likely what he himself would have expected his performers to do.
Mm-hmm. This is the Courante from J.S. Bach's Solo Suite No. 1 in G Major. You find all Juliana's albums linked on her website in the show notes. Thank you.
I put that album out on my own imprint because nobody wanted to publish it. Like, and I felt very strongly about it. They're like, nobody's going to want that. It's like, everybody plays Bach. Nobody wants another Bach album. And I kept telling people, it's like, this is not going to be a Bach album like you've ever heard before. And no one wanted to take that risk. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do it myself. And I did. And I'm so glad that I did and that I followed my gut and I trusted my instincts.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I wanted to let you know about some other episodes I've linked directly to this one, which I think may interest you, with pianist and historian Samantha Ege, cellist Julia McLean, cellist Dorothy Lawson of Ethel, bassist Edwin Barker, and the Euclid Quartet, among so many. It's a joy to be able to bring you these meaningful conversations, but this project cost me quite a bit of money and lots of time. Please support the series through either my merchandise store or on my Ko-fi page. You'll find the links in the show notes. For the merch, it features a unique design by artist Steffi Kelly, and you can browse clothes, notebooks, mugs, and more, everything printed on demand. On my Ko-fi page, you can buy me one coffee or every month. You'll also find the links to sign up for my newsletter, where you'll get access to exclusive information about upcoming guests. Finally, if you're finding this episode interesting, please text it to a friend. Thanks.
Well, can we talk a little bit about the art of ornamentation? Because that's what this album is all about.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. It's got to be the most difficult thing, I think, when you start to explore the world of historically informed performance, to, one, wrap your head around the idea that the notes on the page aren't all there is to the music. When you're looking at, you know, Baroque music, classical music, even I would say music from the Renaissance, what's on the page isn't music. It's a recipe for making music. And the music is what happens in the moment when you're playing, when you're performing, when you're sharing that moment with the audience. And the music isn't complete until you as a performer add in these little improvised interpolations that we call ornamentation. Now, as you know, particularly I think as string players, you know, we are brought up now in this post-19th century pedagogical tradition. post 1945. You know, we've all read Milton Babbitt. You know, who cares if you listen? We are supposed to play what is on the page, exactly as it is written on the page. Do not deviate from what is on the page. I have been, or in my younger days, I was chewed out by more than one composer who just felt that I was not showing adequate fealty to what was on the page. But with Baroque music, what is on the page is just the beginning. I love to say the Bach, you know, is only the beginning. And it's thrilling the minute that you realize there's so much more to it, and that every time that you play it, it can be a different experience, not just for you, but for your audience, so that you're sharing this special, never to be repeated moment, which takes on even greater meaning, I think, in the digital world, where there are like footprints of everything, and you know, we can repeat or discard, you know, at a whim. Here's this thing that's so ephemeral, and you get to share it with however many perfect strangers are in that room with you in that moment, in that performance. And it's something that will bind you together for the rest of your lives. Even if you never see each other ever again, you had this beautiful experience together. But it's terrifying when you've been told to play what's on the page, and suddenly somebody says, okay, what's on the page is, it's like somebody giving you a recipe, you know, for chocolate cake instead of a cake. You know, if you just play the notes on the page, you're just reading a recipe to someone. And quite frankly, if I've been promised chocolate cake, I really expect chocolate cake.
So I'm just curious, when you recorded that album, you would have had to, I'm imagining you tried to do complete takes, or like in terms of the ornamentation and your choices.
It was tricky, and I had a really wonderful producer on the Bach album, Dan Mercurio, who was thankfully willing to let me experiment as much as I wanted to. Because when you're recording, obviously the goal is to, because you know you're going to edit, the goal is to give people the best possible version of a performance. It's a performance for everybody who can't hear you live. That's the way I think of a recording. But so often the producer will be like, great, one more just like that. Mm. And you're like, oh boy, man, I really hope I can remember what I just did. But you want them to line up as well as possible, so that then, of course, when you go to edit, that it's as seamless as possible, and then you don't have to edit as much. So here I am doing this kind of, you know, absolutely antithetical to the whole, hey, one more just like that approach to recording. And we ended up essentially with probably 10 Bach albums. It was a lot of material, and it was difficult to then go through and say, all right, what version of this do I want to put down for this moment? Mm-hmm. And somebody said to me, oh, well, it's completely, you know, at cross purposes to record something that's supposed to be improvised. And it's like, well, yeah, but, you know, Do we not want a world with the album Kind of Blue in it, or anything else by, like, you know, Miles Davis, Charlie Parker? I mean, those are all jazz musicians. Jazz is improvised. Are we going to say never record jazz just because it's antithetical to the spirit of the music? No. Again, a recording is a performance for people who can't hear you live. I love recording because I think it's in many ways just incredibly democratic. It gives anyone anywhere access to this wonderful music, and I think that that's incredibly important.
Yeah. So in terms of your teachers and mentors, you had mentioned Katarina. Mm-hmm. What do you think was the main thing you remember from those lessons?
I think of Kathy, and I think that what I took most from my lessons with her was the kind of woman that I wanted to be and the kind of musician that I wanted to be. Kathy Mainz is one of these women who just doesn't take lip off of anybody. And we've all said that, certainly, I'm sure, about some kind of female figure in our lives. But that's a difficult thing to do in classical music. It is still very much a man's world, and certainly it was when Kathy was playing with the Cleveland Orchestra, and when she was getting involved with historically informed performance. And I admired the degree to which she insisted that she be taken seriously. You know, it's very easy to sort of, you know, I laugh a lot. That's just kind of my personality. but, you know, there can be a certain pressure as women in classical music to act a certain way, to be a little bit softer, to giggle sometimes at the incredibly inappropriate comments that still get made. And she just wasn't going to have any of that. And I thought, you know what? This is the kind of person I want to be. I want to be someone who enters the room and says, I deserve your respect. And as a musician, Kathy is fearless. She's really fearless. And I'll never forget this one lesson. You know, she was not somebody who handed out compliments. And it's that old school of teaching where they're like, it is not my job to compliment you. It is my job to figure out what you can do better so that you can be the best possible musician that you can be, you know, and then they toughen you up a little bit because it's not the easiest life if this is what you want to do. And in my lesson, she says, Juliana, every note you play is so beautiful. And I was like, oh my God, is she going to actually say something nice to me? Am I dying? Is she dying? What's going on here? And I'm like stunned. I'm sitting there in my chair. And she goes, every note is like a perfect pearl. And it's so boring. I just can't stand it. And it was like, there it is, the insult that I was waiting for. But she had a point, which was that every note I was playing was equally beautiful. It's a little like speaking a monotone sentence. If you speak every word with the exact same kind of inflection or volume or tone, then it would sound like this all the time and nobody would want to listen to you talk. And that's how I was playing, you know, without variation in my dynamics or in my tone color, and playing every note like it was equally important. And, you know, it hurt. And I like to tell this story because people always react with horror. I can laugh about it now. but she did have a point. And so when I'm playing now and when I'm practicing, I'm always looking at, am I really capturing the music? Am I using everything at my disposal to convey whatever it is the composer put on this page, to get that out there for the audience? Because it's not about me. If I just wanted to, you know, play the cello and please myself, you know, I could have another job that I paid more than just play for fun. But, you know, you're there because I'm there on stage because the people in the audience need something. And I don't necessarily know what it is. Maybe they've had the best day of their life and they're there to celebrate. Maybe they've had the worst day of their life and they're looking for consolation. Maybe the piece I'm playing, unbeknownst to me, was on a record that their father would play every night when he came home from the plant. And that was the only time that they got to spend together when someone was a child, you know, but they're there for a reason. And it's my job to provide whatever it is that they're searching for.
Yeah. Interesting perspectives. I wanted to ask you, because I noticed you stayed off social media for a long time, but then with this album, you're actually very active in it, really making connections with your audience. So that's the flip side, right?
I do have kind of a love-hate relationship with social media. I have to admit that I find that spending time on social media can be very bad for my mental health. It's just too tempting to start comparing yourself to what you perceive other people are putting out there. And that's not a good use of my time. You know, it's not useful to worry about what other people are doing or not doing or getting or not getting when I could be doing my own work and worrying about what it is that I'm putting out into the world. But I do love that social media gives us as performers a very unique opportunity to connect with people who love our music. Certainly, I think that's something very new for people in classical music, where there's always been kind of this remove between performer and audience that you don't see as much in other genres of music, like pop or hip hop, where, you know, in the concerts, they're standing on stage, they're reaching out into the audience, they're pulling audience members out on stage, you know, during grunge, they're, you know, jumping into the mosh pits. That's not really something we do as classical artists. So it does let me share my work and share a little behind the scenes. Kind of part of my process with people, and I do enjoy that, but it's been a struggle to find a balance between that community engagement and yet not going down the darker path that social media so very easily can offer to all of us. Doom scrolling is not my friend.
Yeah. Well, if we could go back to your album American Woman. So Dorothy Rudd Moore, powerful composer, you recorded her 1971 dirge Deliverance. So I noticed she died in 2022. Did you ever meet her?
I discovered her and her music, you know, for myself. Obviously, she was already, you know, a known quantity. I think a month after she died.
Oh.
And I had that same reaction. It was like, oh, if I had just started looking sooner, I would have had that opportunity to ask her about her work, to ask her how she felt about it, to ask, you know, questions about the music as I was playing it. And I did feel, and this as a woman I've never met, but I felt this very profound sense of loss as an artist in this missed opportunity to engage with a living composer and to ask those questions that we so often wish we could ask when we're dealing with composers, the works of composers who are no longer with us. Working with living composers can sometimes be frustrating. I mean, it's another kind of human interaction, and there's, you know, it's always fraught with equal opportunity for peril and joy. But good Lord, what I wouldn't give to be able to ask Bach a question or two about the suites, or, you know, to ask Dvorak about, did you really mean to make that change there in the Cello Concerto? And we don't have that opportunity. But when you work with a living composer, you can ask them all the questions that you want. And usually they're quite amenable. They want performers to engage with their music. And so having just missed that opportunity with Dorothy Rudd Moore, whose music really resonates with me, it was devastating.
So she's founded the Society for Black Composers. Her husband was a cellist, and also it really, I read that none of her works were published.
They were not published by, say, a publishing house, but if you're interested in the music of Dorothy Rudd Moore, which I thoroughly recommend, her scores are available through the American Composers Alliance, and you do have to pay for them, but they're all available after payment as downloads. So her music is very easily accessible. And yes, it is all in manuscript form, but I find that her handwriting is quite tidy, and I had no problems in deciphering the score, which is a nice change. But the American Composers Alliance does absolutely phenomenal work. Again, much like the Library for the Performing Arts, in preserving and protecting the legacies, the works, the scores, you know, it's stewardship, posthumous stewardship for so many of these composers whose works might, again, otherwise just be lost to history. And that's a terrible loss for us, not just as musicians, I think, but for the culture in general. Anytime it's like biodiversity, you know, when we lose species, the planet is worse off as a whole. When we lose music, when we lose composers, when we lose those voices, we are certainly none the better.
So we'll be including an excerpt from this recording of Dirge and Deliverance. Can you speak to the work a little bit?
Dirge and Deliverance, Dorothy Rudd Moore described as being one of her most intensely personal works, and it divides into two sections. There's an opening dirge, which, you know, is characterized by these pounding chords in the piano, and for me, I had images of Israel in Egypt, marching, you know, through the desert looking for the promised land. And there is this motivic cell in the cello, it's three notes, that is constantly struggling to break free of these oppressive piano chords, and yet is constantly being dragged back down into this sort of inexorable, unending, pounding motion of these chords. That is until the second section, Deliverance, which begins with a very huge dissonant chord in the cello, and then there's a sort of like a battle that is happening between the cello and the piano as the cello is struggling to break free. And I think some of this, I think she did because her husband, Kermit Moore, was this fantastic cellist. The last third of the piece, the whole piece, and a large part of that Deliverance section is actually an extended cadenza for unaccompanied cello. And it's like a soliloquy of sorts. You know, the cello is on the verge of this independence, and it's like it's asking, but what does this independence mean? And are we ever really free? But then the piano comes back in, and they sort of battle it out till the end. The cello, you know, eventually emerges victorious, which I find interesting because Dorothy Redd Moore, in more than one interview, kind of expressed a fairly pessimistic worldview, but at the same time she admitted that there was still something in her that didn't want to be defeated, and I think that that really comes through here in her music and certainly in this piece.
This is an excerpt from Dirge and Deliverance by Dorothy Redd Moore. So her husband, that was the same cellist who asked Margaret Bonds to write an arrangement of Troubled Water?
It was. Kermit Moore was a powerhouse, very much an overlooked powerhouse of 20th century American music. He is this fantastic cellist. He's a conductor. He's a composer himself. And so, yes, he is commissioning Margaret Bonds to do that transcription of Troubled Water. Also, another piece which is, as far as we know, been lost. I'm still looking for it. That's based on her Montgomery Variations. And he and Dorothy Redd Moore both spent quite a bit of time with Margaret Bonds. I think she was a mentor to them when they were first married and living in New York City. And it's wonderful. Like you said, you know, there is a racial divide amongst American women composers, you know, the Society of American Women Composers. It's all white women. But within the Black community as well, there is community, there is family, there is support. All of the Black women composers on the album are connected in some way, from Florence Price to Margaret Bonds to Dorothy Redd Moore. And it's wonderful, again, to see that lineage and to see that tradition, that heritage, that unbroken thread running through American music history.
Yeah. And I'll link my conversation with Samantha Ege to this one. I always suggest some episodes people mm-hmm. will enjoy. And, you know, we talked about how in the Bonds, Florence Price, after she was going through this terrible divorce, and she's a single mom. She moves in with the Bonds, actually.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's a very personal connection often.
Very personal connection. And I think it's important for us as performers to know these things about the composers. I mean, I suppose you could argue that it doesn't affect our interpretation of their music in any way, but I think that our experiences as human beings inevitably find their way into our art. People often just say Florence Price moved from Little Rock to Chicago. Very simple, right? Except they don't tell you why. And she moves because there is a plot to kidnap and murder her youngest daughter in retaliation for the death of a white child. So it's not that she's just moving to Chicago. She and her family are fleeing for their lives. And at the time in Chicago, when she is first coming to national attention, she is essentially rebuilding her life from scratch because she's had to leave everything behind. And then the young Margaret Bonds is a part of that. She, you know, Margaret Bonds wrote about how she was always helping Florence Price prepare parts and prepare scores because she always needed help. And so again, that sense of community, that personal connection. And I think those things must in some way inform our performance, to know what the composers went through just to write the music, just to get those notes down on the page so that we could play them.
Mm-hmm. And we talked briefly about Amy Beach. She was prevented from, you know, she had pushback from her husband, from society.
It's interesting because, you know, Amy Beach's parents were just terrified of her musical abilities when she was a child. And I call her the American Mozart because she is a wunderkind. She's possessed of such fantastic musical gifts. But her parents worry that if she becomes a performing virtuoso, that she is not going to be able to secure a good marriage match. Which, in a sort of neo-feminist, you know, lens, we're like, oh my gosh, her parents are worried about the marriage match. But the truth is that in Amy Beach's world, without a male family member or a husband to look after you, you had very few options for making your way in the world, and you were often in great social peril. So her parents, you know, concern in, to some degree is founded. They were worried about what was going to happen to their daughter. Her husband, Henry Harris Aubrey Beach, admires her musical skills, but when he marries her, he says, okay, performing's off the table because it's just unseemly for a society lady to be performing the piano on stage. And he suggests that she compose, which, you know, that's pretty progressive for a Victorian man to suggest that his wife continue doing anything in music and not just be a, you know, a society housewife. But he then denies her a teacher. You get a lot of kind of conflicting messages here about do this thing, but I'm not going to help you. So Beach, in a very sort of old tradition, teaches herself. Bach taught himself to some degree by studying the manuscripts of other composers, those famous Moonlight manuscripts that he was extracting from that cabinet in the middle of the night and copying down. He got into quite a bit of trouble as a young man for doing that. But Beach is studying the works of other composers so as to better understand how to compose. And I think it's for that reason that her early works in particular often sound a little like other composers. They might sound a little like Brahms or Fauré. Some of them sound quasi-impressionistic. She may have even had a Debussy score in her collection. And she's essentially, I think, trying on these styles, you know, to see how they work, to see how she likes them. But there's still, if you really listen, if you listen to the Beach pieces on the album, the three pieces, Opus 40, there's always this song-like quality and this wonderfully expressive harmony that doesn't sound like Brahms or Fauré or Debussy. And I think that it's very authentically her own and is her own unique voice gradually coming into its own. And you have to admire Amy Beach for being just absolutely irrepressible. Mm-hmm.
This is the Berceuse by Amy Beach from her Opus 40 in the version for cello and piano. Thank you.
So these various women you got to know through research and getting to know their music so well, if there was only one you could have met with, do you know who you'd pick?
I think it would be a toss-up for me between Margaret Bonds, who I think I would just love to hang out with because, to be honest, we have the same favorite poet. Margaret Bonds really loved the works of Langston Hughes. She actually had a lifelong collaboration of friendship with Langston Hughes. A great deal of their correspondence still survives, and she set many of his poems to music, which is just, they're wonderful. They're so good. So I think maybe we could get together and just talk about how awesome his poems are. My other choice would be Helen Crane, because we know so little about her. Mm. And because I had to go to such great lengths to try and piece together any kind of sense of her life, you know, just from fragments scattered across the globe. And it can be difficult when you're engaging in that kind of research to get a sense of the person as a person. You get all the facts. You get the birth certificates, the passport applications, a letter or two that has survived, you know, sometimes just talking about very mundane household things with family members. And you wonder, what kind of a person was she? Was she feisty? Was she defiant? Did she feel that she had difficulty making her way in the world, or was it fairly easy? Did she feel she faced discrimination as a woman, or did she not feel that it was something that touched her? Well, again, all these questions you would love to ask a composer who is no longer here. Mm-hmm. And you know, as soon as they start building time machines into DeLoreans, you know, I'm right there.
Yeah, these six idylls is very beautiful work, and I like that kind of format too, as opposed to like a sonata. It's interesting to have
the little micro miniatures. You know, there's actually a set for violin and piano.
Okay,
that's at the library in case you're interested. I'm sure they're equally cool.
This is the third idyll by Helen Crane from her Opus 51 collection of six idylls.
So, Juliana, you must have unearthed so much music. Do you have plans for a second American Woman album?
I initially hadn't planned on doing a second American Woman. I thought it would just be, you know, sort of repertoire fatigue for my audience. But since the album came out, there have been a number of listeners and even critics who are like, so when's When's American Woman Part 2, Volume 2, The Next Generation coming out? And I think that I will. I might focus instead of on historical composers, though. I've thought about focusing on American women composers who are working now, and how seeing how exploring how that unbroken tradition of women in American classical music continues to this day, and exploring all of the unique voices, everything that those composers are bringing from their own cultures and their own experiences into this wider world of American music, I think could be absolutely fascinating
Yeah,
and a lot of fun to play.
that's wonderful. So you grew up in West Virginia. So were you playing traditional music as well?
I did not play a lot of traditional Appalachian music. Certainly fiddle players do, but I think I might have suggested it once or twice, and the pushback was that, oh, we don't really use cellos. Maybe if you want to play the upright bass, the bass fiddle. And I was like, ah, no, I'm gonna skip it. But I love that kind of music, and I think someday I really do want to spend some time exploring that part of my own musical heritage. I mean, certainly it was something wonderful to grow up with, that freedom of expression and that constant melding of very old and very new traditions. You don't find it anywhere else.
We just talked about some of your teachers. I was curious, like, you had a teacher, Yusun Kim, who has a chamber music career. And when I looked her up, it said she has a cello that's one of the oldest in existence, like from 1576.
Yes.
And I was
Oh,
thinking about the stories that instruments could tell, you know?
yeah. Oh, we used to just, get all dewy-eyed and doe-eyed over her cello, which is a just even beautiful to look at instrument. It comes from that era when instruments were actually often painted, and there are like these beautiful dragons painted onto the back of the instrument. And it's amazing when you think about how old it is that all that detail has survived. And there is something special about an old instrument. My primary Baroque cello is made by the man who made Mozart's violin. And you think about, as you said, all the stories that an instrument, if it could talk, that it would tell about the composers that it may have encountered, or the famous performers, or the moments in history that it might have witnessed. And when you own an instrument like that, I mean, you aren't so much an owner as you are a guardian. You're a steward. You are fortunate enough to add to the story of that instrument, to safeguard it, to maintain it, and then to pass it on to the next generation. And there is almost a sense of immortality in that, in being a part of this greater human story.
Yeah. We talked at the beginning of this about, legacy and your purpose and how the pandemic shut down performing. And you're such a devoted performer. You love connecting with audiences. What did it feel like when you were able to go back and perform again?
It was overwhelming. I don't usually suffer from nerves. I will say some of that I think is because when I was a little kid, I actually did sports. I was a student athlete. I was a varsity swimmer in high school, if you can believe it. But you learn to deal through with your nerves and to perform when you're all kind of keyed up when you do sports. So I don't often find that it's something that affects me when I'm playing the cello. But that first show back after the pandemic, I thought I was sure people could see my heart pounding in my chest. I felt like it was just going to like leap out of my body. And I don't know if it was just if it was nervousness or if it was just that thrill of being in front of an audience again. I think that not purposely, but inadvertently, many of us as performers had kind of taken performing for granted. I mean, especially we're doing it from the time we're children. I started playing the cello when I was 9. And you do it for such a long time that it kind of just becomes almost habit for you, and you take it for granted that there will be a stage and there will be a show and there will be an audience and there will be applause, and then you will go home and feed the greyhounds. And when it all just went away, it was like, it was almost like a death, you know, this presence in your life that had been there, and you just assumed it was always going to be there, and it was suddenly gone. And unlike when someone passes away, suddenly it was back, and you had this incredible sense of, I'm never going to take this for granted ever again. I didn't realize how fragile it really all was. I had always appreciated my audience. I had always loved connecting with them, communicating with them, sharing our love of music. But it became that much more special when I realized just how tenuous it all really was. And I hope that that's something that I can carry forward with me for the rest of my life and for the rest of my career, because I don't want to lose that feeling.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Juliana, and that's beautifully expressed. I was going to close this out, but I really want to follow up with this comment you made about being a competitive swimmer and how that helps you with stage fright. So if you could talk about that.
You know, the thing is, I think in music performance, we tend to see nerves as a weakness. If you're nervous, obviously you're not cut out for doing this. Nobody ever wants to admit that they're nervous or that they're scared before a show. But in sports, it's different. They talk about, you talk about performance anxiety. You talk about the nervousness of getting ready. You talk about preparing in such a way so that when it comes down to game time, it's just, we're just doing what we did in practice. It's nothing different. When I was younger as a cellist, I always had this feeling kind of like, oh, hey, yeah, I've practiced, but now I'm supposed to, you know, kind of do something I've never done before. Like I should be today 10, you know, who I should be 10 years from now, mm-hmm. when obviously you can't be who you're going to be 10 years from now until 10 years from now. And I started realizing that, you know, I mean, musicians, we're like athletes in many ways. We start doing what we're doing at a very young age. It's very physically demanding. It requires an intense amount of training and preparation. So why wasn't I just thinking about playing and performing the same way that I would about, you know, getting ready to swim a meet? You know, you have a very set routine, a set way that you warm up. You have a way that, you know, you get ready, you approach the block, the diving block, you get up on the block, you take your mark, everything is okay. You know, you're sort of checking in little checkpoints here. And then the shot goes off and you're in the water and you just do what it is that you've been practicing the whole entire time. And you focus on that. It's like, I'm just going to do what I've practiced doing. And it gives you something to sort of hang on to rather than engaging with all of those scary thoughts like, oh God, here comes the high note. Oh, I hope I don't miss the high note. Oh, if I miss the high note, everybody's going to notice that I missed this high note. So I do encourage, you know, when I do have a chance to talk to the parents of younger players, and if the kids are interested in sports, it's like, as long as it's not something that's going to damage your hands, yeah, go ahead. There's a lot to be learned. And for kids who play sports and, you know, the parents are all about the sports, but the kid wants to play music, it's like the two things complement each other very well. And even if you're never a professional athlete or never a professional musician, there are life skills and life lessons that you can take forward with you and that hopefully make us all better people.
Yeah. So great. Well, it's just a pleasure to meet you and have this talk today.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please share this with your friends and check out episodes you may have missed at leahroseman.com. If you could buy me a coffee to support this series, that would be wonderful. I'm an independent podcaster and I really do need the help of my listeners. All the links are in the show notes. The podcast theme music was written by Nick Cold. Have a wonderful week.